Welcome, everyone, to this fifth event in our 2021 speaker series, Taking the Digital Welfare State to Court. My name is Judith Rauhofer, and I am DFF's legal officer. With me are my colleague, Jonathan McCulley, who is DFF's legal advisor, and together we'll work behind the scenes today to ensure that this webinar goes smoothly and does not run into any technical difficulties. To give you all a bit of background to the series, over the past 2 years, the protection and promotion of human rights in the context of the digital welfare state has been a major focus of DFF's work. We are particularly concerned that the increased use of digital technologies and automated decision-making systems in social security and welfare contexts violates human rights and exacerbates the over-policing, penalizing, and exclusion of marginalized communities and those who are in need of vital support. As part of this series, we've already explored the impact of the Aadhaar biometric system on food poverty in India, how profiling algorithms decide what level of support unemployed people in Poland can expect from their local labor offices, how the introduction of a new AI system led to drastic cuts in the care services allocated to people in Arkansas who relied on them, and most recently, how the engagement of a private payment company by the South African government affected the rights of social security recipients in South Africa. Video recordings of all of these events are now available on our website. So if you've missed any of those and want to find out more, you can access them there. And of course, also please feel free to share the links with anybody who you think might be interested. Before this series, we already discussed similar issues at some of our workshops, like, for instance, our litigating algorithms workshop in 2019. We've also held a number of one-on-one and group consultations with a range of organizations working on the topic, and based on those consultations, produced a strategic document to inspire conversations on how strategic litigation can be used as part of a broader strategy to address harms of the digital welfare state. You can also find that document and more information about our other activities in the same area on our website. We continue to engage with a range of other organizations on this topic, so not just digital rights organizations, but also racial, social, and economic justice organizations as part of our ongoing Digital Rights for All project. Our objective here is to provide a space to the people most affected by harmful uses of technology, but who are often not actually the ones leading the advocacy or the policy or strategic litigation work, to develop their own agenda. That is a process that our colleague Laurence Meyer, who leads on that project, has recently summarized in a very important and engaging blog post as "Nothing About Us Without Us." So this year's speaker series also seeks to complement all of that work by highlighting how strategic litigation can be used by and in collaboration with these communities to protect their digital and human rights. The topic of today's event is Risk Models Dismantling Data-Driven Fraud Detection in the Netherlands, and the case relates to quite a high-profile case related to a risk scoring model called Siri, that was used by the Dutch authorities to identify those likely to commit welfare fraud. The system relied on personal and sensitive data that was pulled from the databases of a number of different public bodies. And maybe to nobody's surprise, it was then very quickly criticized for being biased, discriminatory, intrusive, and inaccurate. And in 2020, a Dutch court ruled that the law that underpins the Siri system actually was in violation of the right to a private life. The case was brought by a coalition of NGOs led by the Public Interest Litigation Project and the platform Bescherming Bürgerrechten, together with the Dutch Trade Union Federation and two authors. And with us tonight are Merel Hendricks, who is an in-house lawyer at the Public Interest Litigation Project, and Nahed Samur, who is a researcher at the Law and Society Institute at Humboldt University in Berlin, to talk about the case. As part of her work for the Public Interest Litigation Project, Merel Hendricks identifies potential cases, investigates possible areas of strategic litigation, and creates case files. She also holds an important executive role concerning the coordination of cases and the involved parties. And in some of the PILP cases, she is also the attorney at law. Merel studied international law with a focus on human rights and international environmental law, and she has worked as an intern at Paulus Advocaten for Roger Cox, who is a lawyer for the Urgenda climate case. As part of her work as a researcher, our moderator, Nahed Zamour, works on risk profiling at the intersection of religion, race, and gender in police, intelligence, and migration law. She is also part of the Strategic Litigation Working Group at the Center for Intersectional Justice in Berlin. Nahed has studied law and Islamic studies at a number of different universities, including Bonn, Birzeit Ramallah, London, Berlin, Harvard, and Damascus. She was a doctoral fellow at the Max Planck Institute for European Legal History in Frankfurt and clerked at the Court of Appeals in Berlin. She also held a postdoc position at the Erik Kastren Institute of International Law and Human Rights in Helsinki University, and was an early career fellow at the Lichtenberg Kolleg, the Göttingen Institute for Advanced Study. She has also taught at junior faculty at Harvard Law School for Global Law and Policy. I will shortly be handing over to Nahed as the moderator for this event, and she and Meryl will then spend about 30 minutes to talk about the background of the case and the lessons we can learn from it. And while they are talking, we encourage all of our participants to use the Q&A function to ask any questions you may have about the case. The Q&A tab can be found at the bottom of the screen to the right. And we will have 20 minutes towards the end of the webinar to allow Meryl to answer as many of your questions as possible. I would strongly encourage you to, you know, write down that thought and that question when you have it, rather than waiting until the start of the Q&A, because there's nothing worse than just, you know, thinking about something really, really interesting to ask and then having forgotten about it by the time the questions actually come around. And on that note, and with no further ado, Nahed, Meryl, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much. Thank you to the Digital Freedom Fund for allowing me to have this exciting conversation with Meryl Hendricks on the system risk indication. And I think what makes this case so interesting and unique actually is that it's one of the first times, that the use of digital technologies made by welfare authorities was questioned on human rights grounds. And the idea of tonight's conversation is to find out in how far this could lead as a, this serves as a precedent in digital welfare and questions and risk modeling and risk profiling. And I'm very excited, Meryl, to start off by you telling us exactly how the whole case came about. How did it originate? Who did you need to have on board to fight all the way through to the court?
Thank you, Nahed, and also thank you, Judith, for the introduction. Very happy to be here with the DFF event and to discuss this well, landmark case, you can call it, I think. First off, I should clarify that I was not one of the case lawyers working on the Siri case, but I did coordinate a coalition for the PILP. Working at the PILP, my main focus is strategic litigation. So, not approaching a case from a classical lawyer point of view, but more thinking what does the cause need, being the protection of private life, and how can we achieve that, and would going to court help, and what other means could we employ? So Judith already introduced what Siri did and was, so I will not go into that too much, but if there are any questions with regards to how it works, please ask them in the Q&A. Most important thing is, I think, to mention again, is that Siri creates risk profiles. So it's a system designed and actually released by the government on neighborhoods that they think are problematic. And then the risk profiles are addresses where people live that might be a risk, at risk of committing benefit fraud. So there's no indication or any suspicion whatsoever. It's just an algorithm that combines all these data and outcome these risk profiles. Knowing this, back in 2014, there was hardly any public debate on the law that instituted Siri. there were a few critical voices, but not nearly enough for such an invasive instrument. And we so the PILP and the Platform Bescherming Burgerrechten, in English, Platform for the Protection of Civil Rights, got together, and we discussed what needs to be done about Siri. And then we thought, lobbying doesn't help because the law has already been adopted by Parliament. Protesting probably isn't the best option, because how can you protest such an abstract issue as data protection? Then we figured that going to court would actually be a very effective means to stop Siri, but also to start public debate on risk profiling innocent citizens, because nothing was actually, it wasn't being discussed at the moment. It took us a while to start the litigation. We found two case lawyers willing to work with us on the issue. There were other privacy organizations involved. And when we filed a summons and we got some media attention, we also were approached by the largest Dutch trade union, the FNV, or the FNV. So the reason we got a lot of media attention was actually because we also had two famous Dutch writers as co-complainants. They had both been very critical about Siri and the privacy invasion. And involving them in the case as complainants actually sparked a lot of media attention. So one of the writers was in one of the most viewed Dutch talk shows when we filed a summons. And then the trade union became involved, and that actually sparked other processes, which I would be also willing to discuss more. But I'm not sure if I'm going off topic too much, Nahid.
Mara, this is fantastic. I mean, I'm really interested in knowing more exactly, you know, when the media was attracted to that case. But maybe one step before that, I'm interested in knowing what exact data was collected. You were talking about a very invasive instrument here, right? A law passed allowing for enabling government expansion of its power, obviously. So what kind of data are we talking about? Who was collecting it and who had access to the data? Because I assume that to tell that story, we need to tell how, as you said, you know, how invasive it was, how much it was getting into privacy. You know, obviously it was a secret collection of data, you know. Can you tell us something about, you know, the density of collecting that kind of data, which I guess you would need to tell to make that very case also then to mobilize and have more coalition partners coming together?
I'm not sure whether that was the most important part to find other partners to join. It was also, for example, for the trade union, it was very important that Siri was being used only on the so-called problematic neighborhoods, where mostly people of lower socioeconomic status were living. What we found out later on was that at least two or three of the six neighborhoods that we knew were being targeted by Siri also had a large percentage of people with a migrant background. So this was an important reason for the trade union to join, the fact that these people were being targeted and not, for example, rich people who could also commit fraud. But then to turn to your question with regards to the types of data, it was mostly data that people already provided to the government for different purposes. So, for example, your social tax administration, social welfare information, but also maybe some medical data and info from municipalities. All these data you provided to the government for a specific purpose, for example, when applying for benefits. But then to combine all these data for a new purpose that actually created by itself a large violation of private life. And especially this was enforced because of the a non-transparent nature of Siri.
Okay, so that's interesting that, as you said, the non-transparent nature hitting particularly vulnerable, already marginalized, poor neighborhoods, you know, it's that combination of basically information that shows how, you know, the government is not only expanding its powers, but it's also leaving particular parts of the population basically not protected, you know? So the question is, how did it come about that you could win such powerful collaboration partners like the trade unions? I mean, I'm sure you were already busy putting together all the legal information. How did you handle then to really get, you know, all the coalition partners on board and the media on board? You know, is there also the question of, you know, when is the right timing to get all these people together, basically like a big puzzle to bring everyone on board here?
Yeah, so we were lucky enough to have the case lawyers and also the Platform for the Protection of Civil Liberties. They have Tijmen Wisman working there, and he is very knowledgeable on the topic as a professor of law. So we had a lot of in-house knowledge already. And then I was free to sort of more manage the coalition more, and but together with everyone, we reached out to the media. I think there were a few interesting moments that sort of exponentially enforced or enlarged the media attention. So at first we had the writer in the biggest Dutch talk show, which then led to the trade union joining our coalition. Because the trade union joined our coalition, we could make a new round of legal arguments before the court, but we also, through them, got access to the neighborhoods that were being targeted by Siri. So the trade union made a lot of work of working with the people that were being targeted. They led, or together they started a protest march. And in the end, in the city of Rotterdam, this led to the Siri project being stopped by the mayor. So this was already before we won our case. So that sparked a lot of media attention. Then also a journalist in one of the Dutch newspapers, the Volkskrant, found out that no single case of fraud was actually detected by the system. So there was this large invasion of privacy for these people, but no, it wasn't effective for what it was designed for. Then in the autumn of 2019, we were already in contact with the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. We were actually linked to one of his employees on a DFF event where my colleague discussed our case, and actually the special rapporteur was working on a report on digital welfare systems targeting the poor, and then they felt that it was a right intervention for the special rapporteur to write an amicus brief. This is not something that is usual in the Netherlands, but we could create a possibility of sending this letter to the court. So an amicus brief is it's a letter that you write to the court as an expert on your issue, and the special rapporteur, there's this beautiful line where he says that we all run the risk of stumbling zombie-like into a digital welfare dystopia if we do not watch out. He's very critical of the Siri law, the way it works, and this, the fact that the UN actually intervenes in a national procedure, also again sparked a lot of media attention. So what we noticed in February, the 5th of February, we got the verdict by the court, but already the days before that in the media, the Siri case was very topical, and almost every article said there's no way that the court will say that Siri is not illegal, that it's not violating human rights. So we went from 2014 having no political debates, aside from a few critical voices, to actually having mainstream media saying, wow, this system is so bad, it cannot be upheld by court. And I think that's a very interesting effect of strategic litigation. It's one of the goals. It's one of the reasons that we started it. And we also achieved it, and that's great.
And you mentioned the special rapporteur coming in. I mean, was the Siri case based largely, did you win it largely based on domestic law or international law, or what kind of combination did Siri violate law, domestic or international law?
Mostly human rights law. So what was interesting is that the court, I mean, it's been a while, so I might not be completely correct, but they used Article 8 of the ECHR, the European Convention on Human Rights, and they incorporated the GDPR, so the General Data Protection Regulation of the EU, standards on transparency and purpose limitation, I think, and data minimalization into Article 8. So it was an interesting way to approach the topic, but that actually, so the court really judged upon human rights, and that's not a common thing that the court is willing to lean so much on human rights in such a case.
So, I mean, you've won the case, and I think it was the State Secretary of Social Affairs who said that they wouldn't appeal against the case, but you remain vigilant, it seems, because that same state secretary has announced that risk profiling will be part of social welfare questions nevertheless. So did you see any cases after that landmark victory? Did you still see any cases coming out of this nevertheless?
I mean, unfortunately, yes. It was a very important win, and the court really established data protection. And the state secretary indeed announced not to appeal. So Siri was off the table. But then again, the Ministry of Social Affairs is working on a super Siri. My organization is at the moment not too involved in that, but our partners are, so the Dutch Trade Union and the Platform for Civil Rights. And they have also been working on a against actually a municipality that was employing a Siri-like system, but only for that municipality. And they were lobbying also, and I think in the end quite successfully, because the system there was stopped. But then also really other, it's also the government. So the child care benefits scandal in the Netherlands, I'm not sure if you heard of it. Amnesty International also published a report recently that they concluded that there was a racial profiling happening, really destroying a lot of families, children being placed out of their homes because of governments working with algorithms and risk profiles. There was a city in the Netherlands, Roermond. I think Amnesty also made a report about that, which was also using risk profiling to catch people that are pickpocketing, but it was actually only targeted at so-called the Roma people. So there's not enough work still to be done, definitely.
I'm encouraging definitely all of you attending to pose your questions in the Q&A, because I'm sure we're going to have kind of a fruitful discussion afterwards. But I want to question you, Meryl, on the very topic of fraud. I mean, governments use the risk profiling largely to say, you know, it's our duty to combat fraud, especially where public, you know, taxpayers' money is involved, you know. So the fraud argument keeps on coming over and over again in many of the also the kind of cases you've just mentioned now, you know. So could you say something about how, you know, the risk profiling, the violations of privacy and law and the fraud argument, you know, how is that a new pattern of argument we're seeing here that's being used, and how, what would be a best line to say that risk profiling might or might not be the best answer against fraud? And related to that, did any fraud case, did Siri or Super Siri maybe, you know, did Siri help detect any fraud in the first place?
So no, not a single case of fraud was detected by Siri. So that's, I think, a very important point to make when looking at these systems. And yes, the argument of fraud is always used in similar discussions on, for example, racial profiling. The argument of national security is always made. I think the fraud argument, for example, for our clients or our coalition, it was a non-argument because, yes, of course, I mean, it's important to tackle social benefits fraud. But if you look at the complete picture of also tax fraud, there's a lot more money there, probably. The reason to target these neighborhoods where people with a lower social economic status live, that's a tendency that you notice throughout society, actually, that these people are being targeted and have to deal with very difficult regulations. It's almost impossible to fill in a form, even if you are well educated. There's a lot of room for mistakes, actually. And so we say that most people do not intend to commit fraud on social benefits. It's more likely that they make mistakes. But also, I don't think it's... If you look at Article 8 and the ECHR and the way, I mean, you need a legitimate aim, and by itself, fighting fraud can be a legitimate aim. But then if you look at the enormous invasion of privacy of these people in these neighborhoods, and the fact that they have no real option to defend themselves, and the fact that they do not know what data is being processed, all this taken together does not make the fight against fraud, I think, a legitimate aim that can justify the use of Siri.
And so looking back, what did the litigation achieve in terms of strategic litigation? Why did you think strategic litigation was exactly the right means to set that precedent against risk profiling? What is it that you think we can take from there for other strategic litigation cases coming up?
So the way we approach this strategic litigation, I already mentioned that it was important. Going to court and having a judge say something about government policy is interesting to the media. So that's it's more interesting usually than a report. So that's something to take into account when thinking about strategic litigation. And I think the Siri case showed that it was really effective. It's always difficult. I think we were very lucky to have the UN involved, but if you could think of having an international institution or someone very knowledgeable write an amicus brief, that's always interesting. And the reason that we went to court with a coalition of civil society organizations is that because Siri was so non-transparent, it was really difficult to find victims of Siri. So if you know that you are being targeted and investigated, you can do something about it. But if you don't really know, then there's nothing that can be done. So this is why we designed the proceedings as such and had these clients.
Okay, thank you for mentioning that one more time, because obviously in many strategic litigation cases, the difficulty is in finding individuals willing to be part of this collective action. And those individuals tend to be amongst the most vulnerable, obviously, especially when the opponent here is the state, and especially in kind of digital welfare questions. So did you, what is it that you remain very vigilant about? What is it that you think, I mean, it seems that in the Siri case that the parliament was not your best friend, since the parliament has voted the law without any objection. So, and that's why you had to go to court in the first place, and that you mentioned obviously that there was media partnerships that you could arrange for. But when it comes to now upcoming legislation, what do you think you would need to do now prior to having go through the efforts of going to court one more time? Is there something that lawyers can do before they go to court?
So, I mean, I think now it's time for other means of change. So, using the Siri case and this verdict of the courts to lobby, to campaign, to maybe protest. That I think that would be more effective now than going to court. However, if a Siri 2 or this super Siri is adopted by Parliament, then this could mean that going to court is again the most effective way to stop it.
Okay, thank you. So I think I'd love to open up for the Q&A and see what the experiences and comments and questions of other participants are, of the attendees. So please use the slot, the Q&A, also to ask your questions and share your knowledge and experience with us. We have one question from Noor, who wants to know again in which way the data was used. So were you able, for instance, to find out about the information sharing between different government agencies and how it was authorized? And because, of course, obviously there are many government authorities here feeding in the data. So the question is, how did the information sharing, you know, what did the law allow? How did the information sharing actually take place? Is there something more you can tell us about that? Because information sharing seems to be a crucial part of much of risk profiling.
Yes, so it was a bit, let me think about this. I think it would be best actually to maybe check on our website and also check the judgment, because the court also goes into it. But to there was this, so the Siri, the SUI Act actually created the possibility of Siri. And then there were government institutions identified that could start a cooperation, and that would be then a Siri project. And then once they started, they all had to share information. It's a bit weird how it was organized. And there were not many guarantees, actually, for the data protection. I'm sorry if I'm a bit vague, because it has been a while since I dealt with the case. And I was working more on the strategic litigation aspect. So if you really want more information on how the information was shared between the government institutions, then I recommend checking our website and the verdict.
I mean, I understand that, you know, the entire digital sphere remains kind of a very challenging and complicated system, and the strategic litigation then has to make, you know, crucial kind of decisions how to tackle this. But maybe we can take a question then also from Gabriel, who's asking on the impact of judgment in the Netherlands. And we know you've addressed some parts of it, but because Siri was declared to be in violation of human rights, a number of institutions in the Netherlands nevertheless continue to use predictive welfare fraud algorithms. And here Gabriel's thinking of Gemeente Nissewaard, Rotterdam, but also the UWV and possible other examples. So does Siri ruling leave any room to challenge other similar algorithms? Is that something we can use to kind of unpack legally the algorithms that are still in place despite the precedent set by Siri?
Yes, I definitely think so. Yeah. So the Siri judgment was more than the algorithm itself, but the algorithm was definitely also part of the judgment. I think it's a necessary step actually after litigating Siri to look at other government institutions also profiling people in a likewise manner.
Okay.
I would encourage Gabriel, if you can read Dutch, to go to the website of Platform Bescherming Burgerrechten, because I think it was the Gemeente Nissewaard actually where they were working on the to give effect to the Siri case by telling the Gemeente Nissewaard, hey, look at the Siri verdict, what you are doing is wrong. And through lobbying, they actually achieved that the Gemeente would stop using this their own project, which was very similar to Siri.
Thank you. And so would you think that, this is a question from Joseph, I mean, how does then, you spoke about strategic litigation as one way, going to court as one way to, you know, inform the public basically about what's going on and the effects of laws like this. Would it be right that for strategic litigation, we would have to think of a kind of a combination of forces between a media buzz, you know, that basically has to be escalated in a way, and the legal proceedings, like coming together as the lethal tool, as Joseph said it, for tackling this issue. So really, the question, as the way I understand it, is it how would basically the law and the media, how do you make sure that they two are in tune? Because obviously, as lawyers, we have no guarantee what the media is going to be reporting, right? And obviously, when it affects the most marginalized, the most vulnerable, the poor, migrants, there isn't a guarantee that the media would be reporting on cases like this the way that would be beneficial for the court. So how do you, what kind of information is necessary to be provided to the media to help us shape that these kind of cases?
So what information to provide to the media is, of course, very case specific. But to go a step back, I think it is important to mention that going to court is not a solution in itself. It's a means to contribute to a better world, to a solution, hopefully. And in my opinion, and that's the way we work at the PILP, going to court by itself doesn't do the job. So you need to have coalitions with civil society organizations that all have different tools of change in their toolbox. So campaigning is really important. So in the Siri case, the Platform for Civil Rights started a campaign, and they really were very good at explaining the difficult abstract idea of data protection and the way in which Siri was violating it in a really accessible manner. And I think that helped a lot. And they were working many hours also talking to journalists. And the Dutch trade union obviously also has a lot of partners, and they in contact with journalists, and they were also really able to use this tool of protesting together with the neighborhoods to put the issue on the in everyone's mind again. And we just maybe going to court is like 50% of the work, and the other 50% is all the other stuff, which is equally important.
Thank you. I want to address one more question that makes the risk profiling cases so difficult, which is the entire field of transparency, right? So obviously the question is, you know, were individuals who had risk profiles generated about them, were they notified about the existence of the very program used to collect their specific data? I'm sure, you know, there was a bit of maybe some reporting on the law, but did the individuals at risk, how did they find out that there are, that is their very kind of individual fundamental rights being targeted here? And the question is that usually, so it's the transparency question is one regarding the individual plaintiff who you need for court, because obviously the two famous Dutch writers were dismissed from that court case, right? Because they were not individually targeted. But the transparency question becomes also one of the big stumbling blocks in dealing with government, because government is never interested in revealing that transparency, right? Because they would say then it runs counter to the very government policy we want to have in place here, you know? So what did the court say? Did the court help us for future cases about what kind of transparency criteria are definitely needed to have a rule of law system in place?
Yes, so the state indeed did not want to say anything about the algorithm, because then people could adjust their behavior and then the algorithm and risk profiles wouldn't work anymore. People didn't really know that they were being targeted. It was announced in maybe a neighborhood paper or an official state's paper, but nothing you would really read. So you wouldn't really know that you were being that Siri was used in your neighborhood. And then the people that were not a risk report, because not everyone was fitted the risk profiles, obviously. So these people weren't even notified, and their information was deleted after a certain amount of time. And I think that the people that were risk reports and then were being, could be investigated, the risk report would exist for like 2 years. An action could follow, and in those 2 years they would not know there was a risk report. And then maybe, but I'm not sure if I remember it correctly, afterwards they would be notified that they had been a risk report. But all this while, you don't know whether this affects your possibility of applying for benefits or anything else. So it's really harmful. And then what the court said about it, basically, because the state did not want to reveal anything, because the precise nature of Siri was not disclosed, the court also could not judge how violating it actually was and how strictly the court had to test the violation of private life. So they concluded it was insufficiently transparent and insufficiently verifiable, and it was they were just not able to assess whether it was actually a proportionate means to address the violation, if I say that correctly.
Okay, great. So we have time for one or two more questions. So please share your experience or comments or questions with us. But in the meantime, I want to ask you also about the very stigmatizing effects of such risk profiling, because obviously it's about sensitive data, and especially when the accumulation of data comes together. Did the court help us say something more about how stigma, how these policies and laws create stigma, and through that, you know, enlarge the potential, the ugly potential for discrimination. Is that something we can take from the Siri case to, let's say, racial profiling or religious profiling?
Yes. So the court said that the image of a neighborhood as a problematic neighborhood contributes to the stereotyping and reinforces the negative image of the people living there, even if there have no risk reports been generated about them. So the actual selecting these neighborhoods already, there was a risk of stereotyping and stigmatization. And because of the great impact on private life and the fact that there was no transparency, the court judged that there was definitely a risk to discrimination based on lower socioeconomic status or immigration background. I'm not sure how easy this can be used in other cases because it's always really, and it really depends on the context and on the way the algorithm and risk reports are being created.
That's true. I was just trying to see, you know, what is it that we can take away from Siri as precedent for all these upcoming, at least cases we know about, right? That are pending also before court. And so we have another question from Gabriel that I think is hitting on something really important here, which is the involvement of the private sector, right? I mean, government, as much as its powers and are expanding, can't do much of this work without private sectors, whether it's like private health insurance or it's private, educational questions, you know, so to help collect all that information. So what is the role of the private sector in terms of Siri? Is that, you know, are we missing something? Are we missing like an important pillar here by us focusing on the state and not really seeing the role of the private sector, especially in the way that they also help obscure transparency, especially because the private sector does not fall under the Freedom of Information Law?
I mean, that's definitely a big issue. And in the Siri case, what was interesting, so there was a private firm that actually developed the algorithm, but was also testing. So the information was sent to this private firm who was like entering the information into the algorithm and then sending the risk reports back to the government. And then the government actually said that this was good for privacy because this meant that no single government institution had all the information, rather than it being horrible, because how can you hold this private firm accountable? I definitely agree with Gabriel. It's difficult to hold these companies to account. And luckily for us in the Siri case, we didn't have to, because there was enough to go with against the government.
Thank you. We have another question from Joseph, which is an interesting one. The thing is, if risk profiling is increasingly considered to be important or even legitimate, even if not legal by some actors, why is it that you think that the state secretary or the state did not appeal the decision? It seems that there's like almost a contradiction here between, you know, wanting to use more risk profiling and announcing a super Siri, at the same time, not appealing Siri. So it's kind of trying to think kind of strategically and, you know, what do you think is ahead of us? You know, what made that decision so unappealable? But what is it that we need to be aware of coming in future legislation?
So I think it's a really good question. And we discussed it and I was actually not too sure why they chose this path, but I think it was a risk aversion strategy by the state to just, because the media took such a strong stance, the public debate against Siri, and they already had the Dutch climate case where they appealed and then went to the court of the Supreme Court, and that takes so long. And I think if the public thinks that Siri is wrong, then the state should also would be wise to listen to that and to not appeal. And then on top of that, it was because this journalist found out that no single case of fraud was detected. It felt like there was not really a reason to appeal to save Siri. So I think they took their losses. They lost this one battle, but they want to win the war.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So thanks so much for bringing up something that relates to our last question, the kind of the time question, you know, like not only when is a good time to do strategic litigation, but obviously for the government, it's also a question of when not to appeal, when the media has already, you know, has firmly framed that case as a winning case for people on the digital rights front. So on the timeline, the last question is like, also addressed to you as someone who tried to coordinate the coalition. This was, I guess, a race against time too, right? Because you had to coordinate so many stakeholders and so many moving parts, and you had to keep all the deadlines in mind. Is there some insights you could share with us as to how to manage cases with such large coalitions like this? The timing moment, and you know, is there something you could share with us as those also facing those such challenges?
Yes, I really like this question because it's really important and not something you maybe think about when starting strategic litigation. We had a lot of meetings. It was pre-COVID, so we were able to have them live. And it meant that we could really discuss all the nitty-gritty details, the legal nitty-gritty, but at the same time could discuss public campaign, what to do. We always checked with each other when there was a request by a journalist for an interview. We considered, okay, they asked a trade union, but who should we also send along with them to provide an extra perspective? So we were always really collaborating and thinking about all these issues. Of course, we had the case lawyers, and in the end, they decide how to plead before the court. But we, all the civil society organizations, were able to provide a lot of input and to really make sure that the campaign, the message also is heard in court and in the legal documents, and not only the, so that you do not only have the legal win in court, but also the political win.
Thank you. I think this is a very important, obviously, message for anyone interested in strategic litigation or doing strategic litigation, that the law is only part of it, and that the political and the kind of the media message has to be sometimes even louder. So that we can initiate even more debate, or make sure that the debate continues rather than just ends with a particular case, right? So thanks so much, Mero. This was fantastic. And I'd like to hand over to Judith to help us wrap up this particular
talk,
but allow us to engage even further in upcoming talks.
Thank you very much, Nahid. That's great. Thank you so much for moderating this event so efficiently. And thank you also, Meryl, for talking us through the detail of your practical experience with the case and with the case management as well. You're right, that is something that we don't always hear an awful lot about. So thanks for that. And here is now another reminder that this webinar has been recorded and that the recording will be made available on our website and our YouTube channel soon. And for the academics amongst you, please feel free to use this in your teaching and your research and to share it with anybody else you think might be interested. This was supposed to be our final event in the series, but because we had to actually reschedule our event last week, it is not. But we are actually now in discussion with the speaker and the moderator from last week to reschedule. And this is just to say that it's now likely to take place the week after next, either the 23rd or the 24th of November. So if you are interested in talking about that, we are still hoping to welcome Carla Clark and Amos Toe to talk about miscalculating income, taking on digitized universal credit in the UK. And there is still time to register for that event as well by following the links on our website. But for now, I would like to close this and thank everybody for coming here and for being so participatory and giving us all these wonderful questions. I hope that you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. And I hope to see you again next week or the week after, more like, for our final event. Thank you very much and goodbye.